So our next guest is a pretty exciting one to have on our show. As you guys know, I've been in the news business for 29 years, and I'm really thrilled to get the opportunity to talk to Jill Abramson. She's the former executive editor of the New York Times and author of the book, Merchants of Truth, The Business of News and the Fight for Facts. Jill, are you on the line? Can you hear us okay?
Yep.
Your book is about the disruption of the news media over the past decade and the erosion of trust in the country. You look at four media outlets, two traditional newspapers, and two digital startups, each trying to find their way in this fast-paced digital age of news. Jill, there's a lot we want to talk about with the book, but before we get started, I want to get the tough question out of the way, give you an opportunity to address some criticism. Accusations, actually, that the book, which is more than 400 pages long, has about six passages that are taken from other journalists' work. Some are calling it plagiarism. You've taken those accusations head on, saying you never intended to take credit for others' efforts. So can you tell our listeners what happened?
Well, you know, I kind of have explained this to a fairly well for the past 2 weeks. Happy to do it again. We use my assistant and I, footnoting system called Trailing Phrase Endnotes. And we have 835 of those. And every news organization except one that has been raised in the criticism was credited in a footnote. Sometimes the pages were off. So these were sloppy mistakes, but they weren't in no way plagiarism.
Thank you for that. Now let's get to the book. A well-researched insider view of not only the Times, where you're executive editor, but also the Washington Post, as they struggle with declining subscriptions for their print editions, thanks to the advent of Google News and Facebook news feeds. While that's happening, two newcomers to what I'll call the information scene, Vice, which, for the benefit of our listeners, a bad boy magazine turned website turned HBO show, and BuzzFeed, which maybe more people are aware of, a website that started with cute cat videos. They started getting some relevance as news sites. And Jill, I often wondered while reading the first part of your book if it pained you to see these digital sites, which, as you describe them, don't subscribe to the usual rigorous journalism rules of holding powerful accountable and shining light in dark places, but instead they use reader enthusiasm, or what people know as successful clickbait, to measure their success. Was that hard for you to see?
It really wasn't. You know, I've always been at heart an investigative reporter. That's the work I love to do. You know, I set out to write a narrative history of a very tumultuous time in the news business, where everyone seemed to be totally transforming themselves. And it felt like a natural project and a great one for me.
Was it fun for you to see the engagement, maybe a little more of the give and take with the news consumer on these news sites? Did that maybe make you think of journalism a little bit differently than you did when you were at the Times?
Well, you know, I think that especially in doing deep studies of BuzzFeed and Vice, I learned some surprising things. They approach the news a little differently, trying to attract younger audience and younger viewers, because Vice is especially strong in video. And, you know, they believe less in all-knowing editors sitting in a room, you know, in New York or L.A., deciding the order of what stories are important. They believe readers by, you know, clicking and seeing what stories are trending the most, that, you know, engaged readers should be a measure of what stories are most important.
That was what was interesting to me as I read the BuzzFeed chapters, was this notion that BuzzFeed's entire model, I take it, was to simply try to attract clicks, that rather than having any sort of content filter at the beginning, it was, what can we come up with, whether it's, you know, cats in pajamas or, you know,
right,
any bizarre or outlandish thing that would cause people to listen or read, and that their management structure was to monitor simply clickbait. Can you talk a little bit about that and how BuzzFeed went from dancing cats to at least a pseudo-news organization?
Right. Well, for a long time, BuzzFeed, you know, basically got started by Jonah Peretti in 2007. And he was most interested in how to make information go viral. He was fascinated by that. And BuzzFeed, in many ways, was started as an experiment in how information gets shared, what kinds of stories and posts get clicked on the most. And in the beginning years, he was really creating content for what he called the bored at work network. You know, people are sitting in front of a screen, calling up Facebook and trolling through their news feeds. And
oh, Jill, you're getting a little garbled there. Something just happened. Do you mind retrying that answer?
Sorry, I'm on a train. Sorry.
Hopefully you're in the quiet car. You're not in the quiet car.
He'll be done in a sec. Okay, here I go. So from there, in 2012, Peretti decided he wanted to do serious news, like not just adorable puppy photos and listicles and silly quizzes, but that he wanted to do real news. And he hired a crackerjack editor who was great at political news, and the presidential campaign was coming up. And then from there, they built like one of the biggest investigative units of any news organization that I've seen. And they were a finalist for a Pulitzer Prize last year.
But they also had some missteps with BuzzFeed, where they put out this story about Cohen recently that ended up, I guess, not being disproved, but not proved. So as a new journalism enterprise, it seems like they're making some head starts and then they're taking two steps backwards.
Well, you know, in the beginning, it's not surprising that they made some mistakes. The most controversial was that the news editor actually erased some of their early stories from the site because he didn't think they were up to standards. But, you know, their news standards are different. That you'll remember that BuzzFeed alone published the full contents of the Christopher Steele dossier, the British intelligence officer who had done a long investigation of Donald Trump's exploits in Russia. And, you know, their attitude, again, is that when something is known by virtually everybody in the news media, and we find out that both President Obama and incoming President Donald Trump were briefed on this dossier, that, you know, don't the people get to see it? Why should it just be journalists who get to see it? It's a different kind of standard.
On the other hand, this morning's BuzzFeed splash page is still back to the lists and the 21 things that you want to see and the 15 things you should learn about the Oscars. So their transition is still somewhat ambiguous in terms of how seriously they want
to. Yeah, but it is ambiguous. But the interesting thing is to see, like, the Washington Post and some of their apps, like the Post Most, use those exact kind of framings now and you know, have a couple stories that are clickbait every day in their top stories. So, you know, the old legacy news organizations adapted some of the practices that made places like BuzzFeed and Vice grow so quickly.
Yeah, well, the game has definitely changed, right, and how you build your audience and how you develop the channel where when you have a big breaking story, it reaches the masses is challenging. I want to go behind the scenes, though. You were the Washington bureau chief for the New York Times. You were also the executive editor at the New York Times. You know, those are names that imply these are really important jobs at important organizations. But take us behind the scenes. What does a bureau chief do? What is an executive editor at a national organization like the New York mm-hmm. Times, what does that role entail?
It entails supervising coverage of Congress, the White House, the Supreme Court, all of the cabinet offices. You know, lobbying is the beat. Money in politics is the beat, because in Washington, most of the big fundraisers are there collecting checks for politicians, the State Department, so foreign policy, economic policy, because of the Treasury and the SEC. I mean, it's an enormous field of coverage.
And what are your major concerns? What are you working with the reporters on? What are you hoping to accomplish in that role in helping them be the best version, the best reporter they can be?
You know, I think what I did in Washington and also as managing editor of the Times is I always, I always pushed the reporters not only to tell the news story, but I always called it, let's get the story behind the story, like why something happened, who made it happen, and to make our story one that was so rich with detail and analytic points that it was in quality so much better than the many other stories that were done on breaking news that day.
And Jill, what do you think about reporters now and how often they are on social media and how they use social media? So many reporters I talk to these days say, well, I need to establish my brand as a reporter.
Yeah, reporters now are all creating themselves as individual brands. You know, Facebook has a lot to do with this, because the Facebook news feed, which is, you know, 63% of Americans, that's how they get their news, and all the stories are disaggregated from the actual, you know, from the New York Times or the Washington Post, so they kind of float into the news feed as individual things, and so reporters, you know, started a couple of years ago to build themselves as individual brands. And social media presence is certainly one way to do it. Cable news panels is another way to do it. And, you know, what concerns me, especially about Twitter, is just it encourages people to express things emotionally, and sometimes in anger, and, you know, because of the word limit, it lacks the kind of cool distance that I prefer in news coverage. And, you know, I think reporters can be extremely opinionated and even cruel on Twitter.
We talked a little bit about sort of the emergence of BuzzFeed and other sort of non-traditional media outlets. As a business show, one of the things I found fascinating in the book was the discussion of the macroeconomic changes that impacted the traditional print media, the Post and the Times, and how their revenue sources changed over time. Can you talk a little bit about the impact of sort of the decline in advertising dollars and the rise of and how that affected the Post and the Times?
Yeah, it created a tremendous pressure on the business practices and the business model of all legacy newspapers, especially the New York Times and the Washington Post, because beginning really in about 2005, print advertising, which was the most lucrative part of the newspaper package, just started falling off a cliff. And in Washington, for instance, the fall off in print advertising coincided with the closing of like all the local department stores and other locally focused businesses. So it was a rapid and radical drop in the most important revenue source. So, you know, circulation was going down, but not as precipitously. But, you know, and the problem for a lot of the decade that I cover in the book is that while, you know, digital advertising began to bring in some money, it was digital pennies to print dollars. Print advertising was much more costly than digital. So, there was not a dependable business model for either the Washington Post or the New York Times until in about 2011 and 2012. It was really the Graham family, who had owned the Post for so long and had been wonderful stewards of it, just concluded that they didn't have the answers to keep. They were looking at losses for 7 years out. And at the Times, they had to roll the dice and try something that had failed once, asking their readers to pay for digital subscriptions. But the second time was a charm, and that created a new revenue stream. But right now, it's really interesting. The Times has more, reader or circulation revenue by far than advertising.
Jill, this is a bit of a self-serving question. Since we're a nonprofit public radio station with a pretty healthy news staff, we've got 5 news reporters here covering just 2 rural counties in Utah. We're really proud of that. And I think that nonprofit journalism, after being in the for-profit journalism world for 25 years, I'm really coming around to the nonprofit model. Do you think that could be the saving grace for journalism in America?
It's beginning to be, and I'm really heartened by, new initiatives like Craig Newmark is donating $85 million to try and bring back local reporting. So many local newspapers have closed or have been stripped down for parts by the Vulture Capital funds that have taken them over, that, the quality of them has just, gone out the window. And there are a number of new nonprofit initiatives, some of them in localities like Austin, Texas, or Minneapolis, that are great. There just aren't enough of them yet to fill the gap.
So now that you've taken a long, close-up look at all these different news outlets, what if someone gave you a blank check and said, hey, Jill, develop a journalism enterprise that's modeled after your ethics and principles and is also economically sustainable? What would that look like to you?
It would look a lot like what ProPublica is doing, and I think there needs to be more of that, too. ProPublica is an all-investigative newsroom. It's grown tremendously and does fabulous investigations. But investigative reporting is, because it's expensive and time consuming, has atrophied, around the country. And, I'd be interested in doing something focused on bringing back scrupulous investigation.
Jill, we've only got time for one or two more questions. Some that is timely, and you having spent your life as a journalist and as somebody running journalistic organizations, for me as an outsider, when I see the President of the United States holding press conferences and treating reporters with the disdain that he does, I cringe, and frankly, I'm embarrassed. What's your view on that? Just how the president is treating reporters.
I think it's deplorable, and invariably it's going to lead to more violence, especially when he goes into campaign mode and rallies. And the most disturbing thing about it is that repressed for a reason. They saw journalists as bulwarks against abuse of power, and to call journalists enemies of the people is truly anti-democratic.
Jill, we've got about 4 minutes left, and I had to ask you, you were the first female executive editor of the New York Times, and in the book you write frankly about what you saw your shortcomings were. You said you were seen as being someone who played favorites and overly confident of your opinions, that you cut people off and you didn't really listen. But you noted also those are qualities that are seen as leadership in men and are seen negatively as being overly ambitious in women. Please give us some hope. that this will change at some point. And have you seen it starting to change about the attitudes about women in leadership, especially in newsrooms versus men?
Well, no, I think the Me Too movement has brought some change. But for women who are in the top leadership jobs, I think there's still a gender double standard that, you know, is exactly as you described it.
You didn't even talk about your salary when you got the promotion.
No.
And that your two successor or predecessors had management training, and that wasn't even offered to you. You weren't
right,
your best advocate.
I stupidly didn't ask for it. You know, I think throughout my career, the thing that's always interested me the most is the journalism itself, working with reporters and editors on news stories. And I wasn't, you know, necessarily the best management material. I didn't have any background in creating digital products that were going to make money. And, you know, those were the things that were put at a premium. And, you know, I didn't like some of the changes that a digital first world brought, you know, including having the business side and the news side of the Times, you know, work very closely together on many things that used to be separated.
We could probably talk about this for another half an hour, but the last point you brought up, the historical firewall, if you will, between the business side and the news side at organizations like the Times. Talk a little bit about how digital has caused that to break down.
Well, digital has caused it to change because the categories of jobs have changed. And in a digital world, at a place like the New York Times, you need technologists, you need lots of web designers, and then you need, you know, the journalists. And the designers and the technologists, such that they were, you know, earlier, would have been, you know, in early days of the internet, clearly part of the business side.
We've been talking to Jill Abramson, former executive editor of the New York Times and author of the new book, Merchants of Truth. Jill, thank you for your time this morning. I wish we had about another hour to talk.
Yeah, me too. It's a really interesting book and a fun read.
We agree. Thank you so much, Jill. Have a good day.
Thanks so much.